It's Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs. Let's start the show with Lewis Tennant. Here we go. The guests and interviews that you're looking for, with creators, innovators, and so much more. For all episodes and further info, verbalhighs.com is the place to go.
Welcome to Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs, a podcast podcasted from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland, New Zealand. My name is Lewis. I'm the host of the show. This is episode 92 with Amanda Wright. Great conversation. Talk more about what we talked about in a second without any spoilers. Spoiler alert, I'll talk about what we talked about in a second with no spoilers. If you are new here, there because remember how I said, do you remember how I said just a second ago, remember how I said this is episode 92? That means there's 91 other episodes, okay, at verbalhighs.com. Breaking news. I just had the luxury, through the flexibility of parts of my employment week, to watch the entire 90-minute live stream of the first American presidential debate via the Herald website, actually. All I had to do was watch one ad at the beginning, get that 0.004 cents from 2 Degrees. I can remember the ad. Look at that. Bloody hell. That's bloody advertising money well spent. Anyway, I got that from 2 Degrees to the Herald, and then I had a stream to one of the most paywalled news outlets in New Zealand. Goodness. Here's what I took away, and I'm no pundit. No pundits, and nothing I'm going to say is particularly revelatory about the Trump presidency or the US in general at the moment. But what struck me was there were some rules set at the beginning that were basically like, don't talk over the other person during the 2 minute points on each of the six topics. Let them say their piece, and then you can have a bit of banter, to and forth afterwards. And so there was that rule. That was completely ignored by Trump, and bizarrely and like unsettlingly so. So, you know, it's like, how can you win against someone? That's obviously a metaphor for the more broad Trump approach to things. How can you win against someone who just completely does not play the rules of the game willfully and gleefully so? I know that they say, you know, they've always, you know, politicians lie. We know that politicians have an element where they're in it for themselves. I mean, those two things are kind of the human condition amplified, aren't they? But yeah, it really struck home again what level that is at with Mr. Trump. He ignored the moderator to the point where it was like, you can imagine a sort of, I don't know what's a good analogy, a boxing referee, like really trying to pull someone off someone else, and it just not happening, ears getting bitten off and so on. Toes. Probably most distastefully for me, in the completely ignoring and dismantling the rules of the game, were the ad hominem attacks. Like, I know in a heated debate, someone like Winston Peters is very good at this, can do it quite humorously, whatever you think of him, kind of having that wee jab at the person, but it was pretty ugly. Trump in Biden's direction. By the way, for the record, throughout all of this, if it's not already a given with the way I'm framing this, Biden observed all these rules, so it was sort of an uneven ting to begin with. But when the ad hominem attacks moved to Biden's sons, that was particularly gross. If I had strong feels during that whole thing, it was during then. I was like, man, it's just, where are we? Where are we, people?
What kind of fuckery is this?
The one where I really got particularly gross was where he called out another son for being a drug addict. The implication was like he was a loser and so on, and that was provoked a pretty raw response from Biden, I thought, obviously in the quite measured circumstances needed for that thing. Yes, and the other thing was, like I say, systematically dismantles the rules of the game. Like I chose that word very purposely because I sort of thought Trump was a bit of a dunce for a period there, but I'm now more subscribing to that theory that that is very much manufactured for audiences and rallies. I'm not saying in the same breath that you could sit down and debate the finer points of Nietzsche with him, but he certainly had some impressive talking points. I don't mean the content of them, but the way he can orate when he needs to was a level up from that kind of Gumby thing he does in more kind of local speeches and rallies and so on. So it also terrifyingly reinforced the discussion about the kind of nefarious activities he's up to in the background based on that manufactured above-the-line presence being very, very much intended. But I still think he's not the brightest candle in some ways. Anyway, hey, well, look, he's running America, so what would I know? Then at the end, this is really interesting, the audience also had rules. It was basically like STFU, so they could clap at the beginning, they could clap at the end. The two wives got up, it was very civil, they clapped for each couple. And then right just before the live feed cut out, there were two yells from the audience. One of them was greatest president ever, the second one was we love you Trump. But I swear to God, I'm not even like hamming this up for the mic. They both sounded like this. I'll do the we love you, Trump. We love you, Trump. It was menacing. And it kind of made me think about that kind of feels like how maybe a lot of public spaces feel in the States at the moment. I don't know. But with all the unrest there, I was going to talk about a couple of other things today, but I'll leave it there because it's turning into a very long introduction. We talk about a whole lot of stuff, Amanda and I, anxiety, planet stuff. That sounds a bit heavy. Oh, God, radical uncertainty. I started off there. Adoption, fascinating, nature versus nurture. Goa trance, Goa in general. We had a live debate about the history of the fax machine. Oh, just didn't stop. Of course, a lot of conversation about Splore. I've always been fascinated about that event and about event and you know, planning and kind of deployment and all of that in general. Some nice kind of like behind the scenes stuff. And we talked about a particular Splore where Erica Badu was a bit of a dick, and then there were poos in the water on the Sunday, which isn't the best when you're organising something like that, is it? Like the show on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, that Apple thing. There's also Google Podcasts. There's also all your podcast apps. It goes out on RSS, so it should be everywhere. Koha for this episode. I don't even want 0.0004 cents from you. I just want you to share it and maybe give it a like somewhere or leave feedback on something. It's a passion project. It's a passion project. Enjoy.
What kind of fuckery are you?
This is Dr. Tannen's Verbal Highs.
Yeah, it's been a challenging, tumultuous year. I guess I've been in an interesting position where I had a central government contract that's,
yeah.
But I've been able to ride that right through. So, you know, I've been one of the fortunate ones that have had, you know, employment and money and...
Yeah, I'm the same.
Not on the edge of, you know...
Do you want to get in a little bit closer to the microphone?
Yep, no problem.
Yeah, I'm the same. You've got to count your blessings, right, eh?
Totally, yeah.
I just realised I started with quite a gigantic question for someone I've not met before. Are you... Because the last guest I talked to, kind of anxiety and stuff came up, and I think even people who aren't prone to it, now's the kind of time. Like, have you had your moments of anxiousness, or
I mean, anxiousness from a personal perspective,
yeah,
to a certain degree. I think more a bit of despair around the planet, really.
That's kind of what I was,
But, I mean, I've been having a bit of despair around the planet for a while, really, you know, on the whole sort of... climate change, extinction of species, on an environmental level, stuff that really overwhelms me.
Yeah, and, it does to me
and,
as
know,
well.
And I feel quite a bit of despair more around the planet as a whole versus me as an individual. Although I definitely have had my moments of me as an individual. I think it's been an interesting time since I left Splore, and I've really been trying to sort of, you know, find my way and find my space, and during this whole COVID time, for the last 2 years, I've been working on a new project. I mean, this stuff will probably all come up as we go along, but yeah. I've been working on a new project that was meant to be launched next summer.
Is that Cuba Duper?
No. I worked on Cuba Duper as the festival manager, and just for one session. I mean, I worked on Cuba Duper that 1.5 years ago, that had to completely go from being a street festival to be taken inside after the Christchurch attacks.
So. Oh, that's right. So, you know, because more sort of radical uncertainty steps into your realm.
It's been a really interesting
and that's,
I mean, you know, just from a country perspective as well, you know, what we've dealt with in the last... You know, I think the Christchurch attacks was the thing that actually freaked me out more than anything. I just, you know, because it was not something that you had never experienced in your lifetime here in this country, and that really threw me, completely. And then also being one of the team that had to sort of either cancel the event or keep it going, and then how you reprogram an entire street festival in 5 days, and try and convince everyone that it's a good thing to be doing.
And it's that sort of, I so hear that, it's that sort of like really unknown learning curve where in retrospect you might say the right decisions were made, the wrong decisions are made, you just need to make decisions quickly. Yes. And this, funnily enough, ties in with you talking about the immediacy of climate change, and just, we're going quite deep quite quickly here, but a lot of these things that strikes me is... We're getting to this point where these quick decisions are having to be made about things a lot of the time, which is no way.
Yeah, unfortunately, they're just not quick.
No,
they're not quick enough. And I mean, I think the most fascinating thing for me with COVID has been the decisions that were made so quickly.
Yeah.
By our government. Yeah. You know, and I really support what they've done, and mostly how they've done it. But the reality is that overnight, our country had to obey,
which is very different to the Kiwi ethos we know, and I get it.
So, but for me, it was how quickly decisions could be made, versus how long things drag out, and that is
what are you meaning there?
Well, decisions on environmental issues, so I'm talking about how quickly something got decided on a pandemic.
Why can't we do it with A, B, C, and D?
Why can't we make those quick decisions with other things that are actually more important? I mean, you know, I think you can talk about climate change, the degradation of our environment, we as a human species, what's going on, and know that it's actually all connected. You know, COVID has come from, well, we don't know the exact cause, but, you know, if it did come through something like an animal that passed on that virus, it's the only reason that it passed that virus on is because we created the environment and the circumstances for that to happen.
Yeah.
You know, so...
Yeah, I do know. You know exactly what you're saying.
You know, it's like...
It's circular. It's,
everything is connected.
Yeah.
And everything is happening for a reason. And so I think for me it was like, wow, if the government and the world can respond so quickly to this pandemic, why are we not responding so quickly
to the
destruction of our planet?
I guess the answer is, and it's not ideal, but the answer would maybe be that when you see the kind of revolt that's starting to happen with certain fringe elements who spend too long on the wrong parts of the internet, like it comes back to that, our response to really quick decisions being made, and that it's such a catch-22 with humanity. It's like this, like,
totally.
Oh, we don't want this authoritarian kind of, you're doing this now.
Yes.
But I hear you in some instances, you feel like it kind of needs to be done. Oh, it's big.
Yeah.
It's big. Let's go back a little. Where are you from originally? So I know that you kind of found a kind of path you've been on, you know, broadly via travelling, I think, throughout the 90s. But where are you from in New Zealand? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Waikato, and I grew up on a dairy farm between Matamata and Te Rau.
There's a song in that.
Oh, there is. there's a story I can tell you.
Yeah.
But, I grew up on I was the youngest of five siblings.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I had a pretty awesome life growing up on the farm. But I also grew up in quite an interesting sort of farming environment. I guess that's been quite integral as to who and why I am the way I am today, this in these days as well. But I was adopted, but the family I was adopted into, my father was a dairy farmer, but quite a progressive dairy farmer, and actually he was a, I'm not going to say he was a green dairy farmer, as in his practices were green, but actually he was one of the key people in the 70s that was responsible for getting a lot of our forests, our native forests saved.
I was going to say, for the time, he was green and progressive.
He was very green and progressive and quite liberal thinking in that side of things. He understood that when native forests got cut down, that the runoff and the sediment and the degradation of the soils and the outcomes of what went on with that was huge. So I had this interesting upbringing where, you know, we were a reasonably conservative family in many ways, in some thinking, but then in others that was quite liberal.
So it sounds to me like you got a quite a, I kind of like that, it's quite a good grounding to begin with in a lot of ways, because you know, the whole everyone seems to be polarized one way or the other at the moment. You got a grounding in, and can I ask, because it's another sort of hot button topic these days, were his contemporaries, were other farmers, did they kind of, were they, did they thought he was full of
I don't know what other farmers thought of Dad on his conservation side of things. Possibly a lot of them didn't even really know about it, because Dad then, you know, he was part of what was back in those days called Native Forest Action Council.
Yeah.
And there were not a lot of other farmers in that sector. So, you know, I think he probably kept it reasonably quiet. He wasn't out there, you know, because it wasn't so much around farming practices; it was more around the forestry and the logging practices that he was dead against. Although he was also very progressive in his farming practice and approaches, in the sense that he was, you know, pioneering, as I would say, what he did. He was, you know, one of the first farmers that got a rotary cow shed, and also things like wintering barns, which is very unusual, particularly back in that time. So big barns where if the weather was really bad in the winter, they would put them in there overnight and they'd get fed hay and then they'd go, so it didn't destroy the pasture,
for
example. You know, it was more around that versus, you know, locking the cows out to, you know.
And has a number of that stuff followed through? Oh my gosh, man, my blooming phone. This has happened twice in a row now, two episodes. Sorry about that. And so some of those practices followed through to today?
Yeah, well, I mean, my dad remained a farmer for a very long time.
Yep.
You know, he's now 94.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Still on the family land?
No, too hard. Sadly, they left the land not that long ago after they subdivided 10 acres and grew olives for a while.
So he kept it working all that time?
He kept it working all that time. And then, sadly, my sister passed away 7 years, coming up 8 years, no, 7 years ago.
Yeah.
And that really destroyed them, as it would with any parent, losing one of their children to cancer. And they just decided they needed to move to Hamilton, where closer to family, and they needed to leave the farm. It was just getting too hard. And that was hugely tough. He'd been on that land since he was born. And
no, I can feel that. Yeah, and you're telling that story,
it was,
right?
It was really sad, actually.
Yeah.
And it was very sad to leave that land.
And go to the city.
Yeah, go to the city. Well, they're actually just on the outskirts of Hamilton on a 1 acre block.
Oh, great. You know. So there's still a bit of land there.
Yeah.
And then so from there, this is like one of those graphics at a documentary of a plane going...
Yeah.
How do you end up discovering the scene in Goa in 1990?
Yeah. I mean,
what I mean there is, before you answer that, is I assume you didn't. It's very early times for kind of the dance music, outdoor music scene in general.
Sure.
I'm assuming you didn't go there knowing it was there. You found it there.
I did know a little bit about it before I went there. I mean, I left school halfway through my seventh form year, and I moved to Tauranga and studied horticulture for a year. And then in mid-1985, I moved to Auckland. And I stayed in Auckland for the 5 years, basically. And I you know, I was really into the music scene back in the you know, the whole indie band music scene. And, you know, I loved a good party. That was always part of my heart and soul.
Good.
And, you know, I went between all sorts of different jobs, working for a River Rats rafting company. Then I ended up working for Telecom. I did all sorts of things. I had no set
career path. Where are you, like late teens, early 20s?
Yeah, so I moved up here when I was 18. And so, yeah, I pretty much stayed here. 18 till, and I left on my 23rd birthday. I left New Zealand and went travelling. And in that time, I'd had a flatmate that had come back and had been to Goa, and she'd said how great it was. And then, yeah, I headed off to Indonesia and went travelling through Asia. And as I went, I met people that were all from that sort of, had done a lot of travel in India. Also, Koh Phangan in Thailand, where, and what's the other island? Koh Phangan and Koh Samui, which were the big party islands where a lot of the outdoor, the first sort of
Underground music, or
I mean, of course it was underground back then. I mean, it was you know, everyone thinks back to, you know, when they think about Goa, they think about psytrance. Well, I mean, the early days in the '90s, there was no psytrance.
That's what I was going to ask. Yeah, what was getting was this really, is the music nerd in me. What sort of thing was getting played?
It was kind of a lot of electro-y sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Beats, 100% electronic. Yeah. And I guess that's the roots of early day trance music. In fact, I was looking at some videos the other day, and the other interesting thing about...
It's weird watching videos of stuff.
Well, back from that, but I watched it and I went, oh, no wonder I fell in love with that place.
Yeah,
I mean, it was, you know, I guess where the word trance music came from, when I look at how we were really in trance, yes, of course, there was drug use and everything that contributed to that sort of psychedelic space, being in nature, being with tribe, there were so many different nationalities there.
That's what I wanted to ask there was, two things, we've got two prongs here. I mean, genre is something that happens after a thing often, right? I can tell you what I would recognise as a Goa trance record, years later.
Yeah.
But the other thing I was going to say is, back then what also interested me, because you obviously ended up being a lot on the organisational side of putting things together, and I nerd out on this stuff as well. I know in future years was a big kind of Israeli scene, right? So what I'm asking about is, who kind of made this all happen in Goa initially? Was it the locals or some sort of like...
Yeah, well, that's a really valid question. It was a combination of the locals with the internationals. Goan people. So I guess the interesting thing about Goa was it was...
Pre-internet, pre-anyone connecting globally, it's fascinating.
Well, I just want to say, when I first went to Goa, that was pre-fax machine.
Yeah, it wasn't pre-fax machine. Fax machines were around in the 80s. Give yourself some credit.
Well, I mean, when I... Well, I didn't find out about them until a bit later. But I mean, when I went travelling,
that is the quote of the episode.
Yeah. I don't know.
Oh, our party prefax machine.
No, honestly, but I mean, here's the hilarious thing. Back then, I mean, when I was travelling, so 1990 was the big year. I left in mid-1990. By November 1990, I was in Goa, and I didn't leave for 6 months. But when I first went travelling, you only got messages via the post ristante, you know, there wasn't the fax machine. Well, there certainly wasn't the fax machine in Goa at that point.
No,
that
sure.
came a year or so, two later, etc. But anyhow, so who put on the party? So, I mean, obviously, the extraordinary thing about Goa was the multi-nationalities that came in there.
Yeah.
And it was quite interesting, being a Kiwi amongst quite strong cliques of different nationalities. So you mentioned the Israelis.
Well, it just became a sort of a trope, didn't it? You finish your compulsory military training,
it was
the more alternative ones end up there.
It was rite of passage for a lot of them. And also then you had your your Germans, you had your French, you had the Italians, you had the English, you had, yes, but I mean, a lot of mixing and crossing over, but there was quite strong cliques and niches of different groups of people in there that was fascinating.
Yeah,
And so being a Kiwi was wonderful because you could sort of just flow in between and you weren't...
Must have been very eye-opening compared to rural New Zealand.
Well, Auckland City, it was quite eye-opening compared to Auckland City. It was eye-opening in so many ways. I remember the first party I went to, the first proper party where everything was sort of, you know, painted up and the sound systems and the people all sort of dressed up. But it wasn't really a costume thing, but there was lots of, you know, I don't know, fluoro and tights and everything that sort of happened back at that time, which now actually it's just done a full cycle and that's exactly what happens out there now a lot of the time at parties.
Really? It's going back to that? Yeah, right.
Well, you know...
The kind of, for me, it would be like on-train era for me, that kind of...
Yeah. Well, that's right. But, you know, you just have to look at things like, well, whether it's Om or Splore or whatever, you know, they've got a lot of people out there in their psychedelic clothes.
Why not?
Yeah. Anyhow. Whatever.
I can't think of the word. Things come and go.
Of course. But I'll never forget that first one. It was just like I could never have imagined anything quite like it in my wildest dreams. And I went, this is it. I don't need to go anywhere else. If this is what, you know, it was incredible. The music, the dancing, the vibe, the energy was extraordinary. So, yeah, I consequently ended up staying there about 6 months. And the parties were put on by locals or different so there were DJs.
Yeah.
And back in the day, now this will be the quote of the day.
You can't beat the fax machine. Don't try and beat it.
No. How do you think they used to mix music back in that time?
Oh, this is where when I was doing what we talked about, my reading beforehand, I can actually answer that. Is the answer DAT tapes?
Pre-DAT tapes.
Oh, okay.
That's how I began with DAT tapes, right?
So what I read is there was lots of dirt and lots of dust around. Yes. So if it wasn't records, not cassette tapes.
Recordable Walkmans.
Two Walkmans
Walkmans. But they, you know, Sony actually produced a beautiful recordable Walkman back in the late 80s, early 90s. And then following from that was the DAT machine.
Yeah.
So, and that's how the parties happened, was mixing two recordable cassette machines.
And so someone recorded, I assume, a dumb question, they were just recorded the music off vinyl or whatever it was to get it out there. Mm-hmm. Great.
Exactly. And,
hey, so as an aside, let's base your experience on the entire globe now. I feel like, someone your age when you did that these days, do you think as many people are doing that? Sort of free abandoned travel these days?
No.
So the world's changed, right?
Well, the world has definitely changed. Oh my God. Of course it's changed. The world changes every day. I think back, you know, this is 30 years ago.
Yeah.
I'm 53 now. And at that age, it was our rite of passage to go on our OE.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know if OEs happen on the same level as what they used to back then.
I think they're going to London for 2 years and coming back still happens, England or whatever. Yeah, it's a curious one.
Yeah.
I've just been looking at my younger cousin who's 18 or 19 and feeling a bit, I don't know, a bit sort of like down for where his generation's at because he's kind of stuck on inside wondering where this year's going to end up, you know.
Well, I mean, I had lots of friends, kids that were heading off overseas on their travels, you know, and were booked in to go to festivals all through Europe and they can't do it. So is the world travelling in the same sort of way? Well, it's actually easier to travel.
True.
Right? Yep. It's less expensive to travel.
True.
There is so many more opportunities and places you can go nowadays. So whether there are...
Would you just get work place to place? I didn't even think about that till you said it. You just get a bit of work each place you're travelling through before you started DJing, like to move from one spot to the next?
Yeah, so I ended up with a German boyfriend living in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And
wow, that's very global.
So I spent two summers in Amsterdam, and did quite a bit of work. Actually, that's when I sort of started working. I mean, I was following. So basically, what happened with Goa is you'd have all the everyone come to Goa for the season. So the season was from sort of November to April, and then after that, everyone would return to Europe or their chosen homes. And then the festival scene, the outdoor festival scene, or as the case may have been in London, the warehouse rave scene or whatever, would then take place. So there were plenty of parties going on outdoors, particularly in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland, and Holland.
Because the warehouse thing, I mean, clubs even one step removed from that never really appealed to you from what I could deduce, right? You like the being outdoors is a big part of the experience.
Yeah, I definitely love the outdoors side of things. That was just because that's what... Gone.
Oh, your headphones gone. I can still hear you.
There we go. Okay. Now something happened.
Expensive device there.
I was definitely attracted to the outdoor scene much more. Yeah. That's where I felt my sense of freedom and comfort, and that's where I fell in love with it. So that's kind of where I wanted to stay.
And then there's another step in any kind of group or circles or scene or whatever you want to call it, to kind of like actually be able to step up and kind of play music and stuff. How did you get involved with that? Because if it's cassette tapes and stuff, I'm thinking it's not as easy as walking into a record shop and buying the tunes or...
Yeah, so I guess there was lots of swapping and exchanging of music.
That's great.
So, you know, lots of recording from each other.
That's the opposite ethos of a lot of other scenes.
But I actually got into it. I mean, I guess there was one person that really inspired me. He was a Kiwi, a guy called Ray Castles, and he was one of the sort of well-known DJs in Goa. So I sort of connected with him. I just knew various people that I was inspired by, but with the music they were playing, and I thought, I'd quite like to give that a crack. And then I can't even remember how it first happened. Anyhow, I bought a DAT machine because DAT machines suddenly became the new thing.
Yeah, makes sense.
And started to... record music and swap music. So I started swapping and exchanging music in Goa, and then when I was back in Europe. So I went between Goa and Europe basically for 7 years. So
you don't strike me as someone who'd kind of measure yourself based on this statement, but it occurs to me you're one of New Zealand's first kind of international touring DJs, aren't you?
Oh, God. I mean, I guess I did end up with an agent that booked me from Germany.
Amazing.
And that was incredible. And so, you know, that's how I also survived. And
great.
Apart from
fantastic.
Also while I was over there. So one of my best friends here in New Zealand started making a really cool range of clothes called Natty Tat. And so I was selling her clothes, which were perfect for sort of festival party wear sometimes at the festivals, but actually I would just get a shipment of clothes in from New Zealand, and my Swiss or Dutch friends would all sort of be lined up waiting to, as I pulled it out of the boxes, to buy it. So I was also spreading the love about, you know, New Zealand products and, you know, the brand and people.
Yeah.
It was quite interesting being a New Zealand woman in those places, because it's one of the few places that I actually felt quite exotic.
No,
it's true.
Because
you know, if you go to England, you're just a Kiwi. Yeah. But in Europe, and I think they were also quite fascinated by this sort of strong, independent, free woman that was just doing her thing.
Yeah.
Not that I was, you know, I'm just saying it was fascinating.
No, what you're saying makes perfect sense.
And
I was
fearless. I had no fear. I was very confident. I was very able to just, you know, move amongst the different groups and the different people.
I think I ask for people who've got involved in quite esoteric endeavours. Did your parents get it?
My parents didn't.
And that goes a number of ways. It's like, we don't get it, we're concerned. We don't get it, but have a good time.
My parents were most concerned,
right.
Particularly my adoptive parents, whereas prior to me leaving, I had found both my birth parents.
I wasn't going to ask you about that.
No, that's all right.
Interesting.
Because that's actually, you know, when I said there's a good story.
Yeah.
That's another story. But when I was 19, I met my birth mother. And when I was 21, I met my birth father. My birth father now lives in Denmark. But I met him here in New Zealand. And so that's been, so, so, but Both my birth parents got it because my dad had also been a traveller.
So there's some you got some serious nature versus nurture contemplations going on there for your life, right?
There has been a massive amount of that, and it's really clear that.
Yeah.
Interesting enough that the nature versus nurture.
I've got it not through being adopted, but through having a parent who is fairly dysfunctional, but who I have had enough glimpses of in my life to realise that some stuff I just wasn't taught. It's in my DNA.
Right.
Do you kind of get what I mean? I have one person who's come in and out. It is fascinating stuff. I think it's totally a mixture of both.
I think my ideology and has definitely come from my family that I grew up with. Interesting enough, very similar in lots of ways to my birth parents. But, you know, you meet your birth parents for the first time and you hang out with them for a little bit and you've got these habits that are identical.
Oh, my gosh.
And you've never spent a minute of your life with them. And the next minute,
the mannerisms,
it might be
and so
the way you scratch your nose you laugh or the way you... You know, I don't know, but it's and more and more as I get older, I go, oh my God, I'm so much like my birth parents. And then suddenly I hear I'll say something.
So you've maintained that relationship with them?
I have a relationship with
them. I guess it comes with being adopted, right? Your adopted parents, did they?
They were very supportive of me always.
So interesting,
Or very supportive of me finding my birth parents. And
did they even? So just to cap this off with the first question where we started with that, which is like, what did your folks think of it? By which I mean your adopted folks. Did they? Where was the penny drop? I'd imagine if it wasn't early, it would have been coming to explore and going, oh, okay. Like, did they?
When did my parents finally recognise?
Well, did they? Yeah, did they?
This is
a demon I'm tapping into of mine that I need to hear someone else's.
No, that's so brilliant. I'll tell you one of the best things. I was having a giggle with my brother the other day about.
I want to be understood.
Yeah, no. Guess when my parents finally went, God, she's made it in life. Okay. We get her now.
Yeah.
Is when Kim Hill interviewed me.
Oh, beautiful.
They were like, her daughter's been interviewed by Kim Hill, and she actually managed Kim Hill. Such a moment. It was like, so that was actually definitely a penny drop moment.
I play a thing to my students, Tom Scott from Homebrew, when he pretends to be his mum as part of the interview. That sort of sounds similar. He's like, I'm not going to do it right, but it's like him pretending to be his mum going, he's on Kim Hill, he's going, oh, you're with the most famous journalist in New Zealand. I'm really proud of you. But it's sweet. It's lovely,
No,
man.
No, and and I think that's the beauty of life is that at some point
it's maternal and paternal concern for the best reasons.
Of course, and sometimes they just don't understand what you're doing.
Yeah.
Right?
No,
and,
totally.
And while my adoptive parents never came to Splore, both my birth parents have come to Splore, and I've had nephews and nieces. I mean, they get it, but, you know, and... Because
what you're describing back then is so far out compared to like New Zealand at the time. I get it, you know.
Yeah, no.
And so you come on back here, and this is again doing a little bit of reading. You discovered kindred spirits, but was there a bit of what's the word? Not anticipation. I can't think of the word. A bit of like trepidation on the plane as to what New Zealand would be like coming back. Or were you ready to come home?
Interesting enough, was ready to come home.
Yeah.
I had in the 7 years that I've been away.
Culture shock.
I'd popped back a couple of times, and I'd started to see things progress. And things like cyber culture had opened up when Mike Weston was running cyber culture.
Yeah, I've had him on this.
And his partner, Isolde at the time, had a fashion label called Seed. And actually it was, I popped down to see these guys. And Heath Bourgeon, who runs, Heath, he's now got...
I know Heath when he was at Cyberculture because I was from Wellington and I bought a record or two when
I
came up.
Retro, the antique shop on K Road.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Anyhow, Heath, so I remember I popping down there. I think it was back in 94. I popped down to see Mike and he goes, doing a bit of DJing. He goes, oh, Verona's got a party on tonight. And he said, you should go and ask them if you want to DJ.
Get old Verona.
And off I popped and I went and introduced myself to Hillary and said, hi, I'm da-da-da and I'm a DJ. Do you want me to play tonight? She's like, why not?
Great.
And I got to have a little DJ gig there. Of course, a lot of them had not heard that sort of music that I was playing, which was
even K-Row was a bit more wild then.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, no?
And so I'd come back and I'd had a little taste of how things were progressing in New Zealand, you know, because it was a bit bland when I left.
We've gone full circle. I don't want to go there. We've we live. The world is in safe land. Anyway.
Yeah. So yeah, came back. And was ready to come back. I think also what happened for me in Goa in 1997 is I actually had enough. I started to see things really changing. I started to see things changing in India.
Were you starting to burn out a little just from all the travel? And
no, I was just more disappointed with...
I heard about what happened with Goa. It's like a lot of scenes. It gets taken over a little.
Yeah, it got taken over, but not just Goa. Litter. It was also what was happening with India. Yeah. And I don't know. There was just I was just starting to feel uncomfortable there. I felt more uncomfortable there 7 years later than I had when I first went there in 1990.
Something along the lines of it starting to turn into sort of like the well-worn kind of Bali tourist trail, that sort of vibe? Or?
There was a little bit of that, but what was happening is that there was the Western world was having a much bigger influence. It was Reagan times, the war on drugs was happening. Yep. There was a USSR had broken down, a lot of Russian travellers coming for the first time they'd ever left. And not just coming to travel, but absolutely disrespect, having any sort of respect for the culture. You know, women walking around in miniskirts and, you know, not covering their shoulders or, you know, outside of Goa I'm talking about, in the Hindu and Muslim places where there was very little respect for the culture that was going on. So we started to be perceived as trashy.
Western
women were starting to be
so obsessed. You start to by proxy get a different attitude and vibe
so came home and was ready to give it a crack back here and you know was keen to continue my DJing, was keen to look at doing some parties or festivals. And in 1998, I started a company called Mycelium, which was a kind of like a talent agency set up to promote DJs, VJs, street performers, and certain brands of New Zealand clothes, which was Natty Tat, and also Love, which was Paul Sweetman's brand back in the day.
Yeah, I had one of those bags.
He's just redoing them, bringing them back to life in a different form so that they can handle telephones.
The only man bag I'd consider wearing, the little tiny ones, are quite cool.
Yeah,
no, very of the rave era.
They were. So anyhow, you go. So I started this agency, which was really to promote all these people, but during that time also myself and Jamie and Anne Larnock and various people were starting to do these small underground outdoor parties, completely renegade. We were really keen to sort of build and grow on that. And then what happened with Mycelium is it did continue to grow, but we kind of used Mycelium as the production company that ended up being a production company that launched Splore.
Yeah.
But pre the first floor, I got invited to go to America to DJ at the launch of a record label called Blue Room in San Francisco.
Yep. Good era for San Fran.
For San Fran. Totally. And they took me out to Burning Man. And that was my next tipping point of tribe community.
Did you
and
by any chance meet any of that sort of, there was a sort of a sort of weird crossover, there was a hippie house scene over there at the time, like Dub Tribe Sound System and all of that?
Yep.
I really liked those records for a minute.
Absolutely. So it was a really interesting time, and that was, for me, it was like, well, I finished with Goa, but here's my next thing, which was completely different from Goa and also in a very different environment, but also it had elements of the stuff that I'd loved about Goa, but it was on another plane and a different level. And
in San Fran?
In San Fran and Burning Man.
Yes, of course.
Out in Nevada desert. And it was actually the most mind-blowing thing I'd ever seen.
Burning Man's such a mystery to me, and like I've been around, but it's sort of like,
well, that's changed, like so many things. Yeah. And when I went,
it's been some unfortunate things happen in the last few years.
Yeah,
as well.
There has. And
but anyway, let's concentrate on.
No, but what I wanted to say about that is that Burning Man ended up being my it was my calling each year. I went back to Burning Man each
year for four years
in a row.
That's what's fascinating about it.
And I was probably one of the first Kiwis and definitely out there that was, apart from a couple of others, that went out at that time. And that's really influenced how we built and developed Splore up over that time.
Just as a quick aside, so Did you have anything to do with Kiwi Burn, or is that?
I've only been to one Kiwi Burn, yeah. So I'm not a Kiwi. I'm not the right person to ask about Kiwi Burn.
Right, but it was this.
But Kiwi Burn was born from Burning Man, absolutely. And they do these regional burns around the world, and Kiwi Burn is one of them.
So around this time, totally preaching to the choir here. This is for listeners. The on-train, on-train, whatever's turned into the Gathering. It's at that point of the Gathering, in my opinion, that sort of the halcyon days of it before it went off the hill and got a bit fugly. But you guys are doing something in Auckland, but you're kind of like far enough away and there's enough people up here to do something while that's popping off down there. Is that kind of...
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, the Gathering story, and I'm probably not the best person to tell the story, but I can tell you that the Gathering was, in so many words, was kind of... hijacked from Entrain.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, I've heard.
And anyhow, that's in the past now. But so one of those people that were the core Entrain people was Jamie Larnach.
Got you.
Which so we came together to do Splore.
I get what you're saying.
We wanted to do Splore because we wanted to do something that was a closer to home and also represented our Auckland scene and the fact that there was a whole group of us that were... I mean, that's also the same time that Normanby Road was all starting. Yeah. So, you know,
I'm not an Aucklander, but I know of all of this. I lived up here in 99.
Yeah, right. So that was Normanby Road time and, you know, all these things were starting to happen. So I guess we just...
That Micronism album's amazing.
Oh, God.
That's just a Kiwi. In general, that is an extraordinary New Zealand album.
Absolutely, yeah. Totally amazing.
Yeah. Just thought I'd put that in there.
Yeah, no, it
just made me think of that time and era.
Yes, you're right. When we started Splore, I would say the Gathering was peaking.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it really was coming to that time where the pilgrimages of people from around the country went to the Gathering. And we weren't trying to compete with the Gathering. It wasn't about...
We just wanted to do something up here.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
And, you know, the first Splore, I think we had, you know, six hundred people come.
99 or 98 or something.
New Year's Eve, 1998-99 was the first Splore. And it was over 3 days in the dusty hilltops.
Friends and whānau, eh? Like, you just word of mouth.
We did a little bit of advertising, you know, and we had people
just
there.
Just koha for the sound system
We sold tickets. Great. I think they were about $40 or something, you know. And... you know, some key people came to the first Splore, which ended up being, like, Morgan Sibbald was one of them, and he ended up being my, he approached me after the first Splore saying, I think you've really got something, I'd really like to work with you on the next one, because we just thought it was going to be a one-off.
That was fun. Pack it all down. Oh, so freaking tiring.
Yeah, all that stuff.
But
anyhow, Morgan Sibbald approached... And we ended up doing the... And Morgan also had a... He was young.
Yeah.
He was like probably 19 or 20 when he approached me. And he also had a... But he was really connected to...
I don't know who that is.
So Morgan Sibbald...
You said it like I... Like,
no, I don't know. I don't know. Have you heard... he was a... Yeah.
He's still in New Zealand?
No, he's very international, Morgan, nowadays. Right. Morgan was a young entrepreneur.
This
and
could be what I look up afterwards, yeah.
Zoe and Morgan, have you heard of a jewellery label here in international? It's Zoe and Morgan.
Okay, yeah,
so
right.
So his...
One of those guys.
Just one of those guys and families, very entrepreneurial, very connected.
Yeah.
So Morgan came aboard and we did the next Splore together. He was also connected to... the house scene, the drum bass scene, and he brought in some, you know, not that the first Splore was all about trance by any means. We had house music, we had drum and bass, you know, but actually Morgan had a bit of...
I like
of
that, and that's quite a New Zealand thing, or at least it was back then. Yeah, it really is. Like, you know, I miss that at nights in the city, like it used to be, just one DJ play this, play that. This is just reminiscent stuff. Anyway.
But you're absolutely right, Lewis. But, and there was no, there wasn't so much clicky, niche-y stuff back then.
You're such an engaging raconteur that I'm actually going to get to my first actual written question here. I'm serious. So, Splore, like you said, it's inspired by Burning Man and the trance scene. And I know that you've spoken about this when John came on board in 2004. But in that kind of 5-year period and moving into that stage, you know, the trance scene's underground even in a dance music sense, to me at least. What was the balancing act like, or the kind of movement through, you know, ending up wanting to make it a more commercially viable operation, as you kind of said, from 2004 onwards? Was it sort of, is it a tough thing to reconcile? And I'm thinking, you know, keeping that balance, and you probably thought about it all the way through to your left, right? Keeping the roots while
well, I'm going to be perfectly
honest. Was that a lot of wobbly, bobbly, jobbly nonsense, or did that make sense? That's a question.
Okay, so there's quite a few questions in there.
Yeah, it's a Lewis question.
So first of all, when I came back from overseas, I was also, my music styles had were already starting to change. At that time, things were going into what they called breaks trance, which was a lot more breaky sounds.
Yeah.
I think by a year later, I was playing drum and bass.
Yeah.
and breaks, and so I
just got to play what moves you.
And I loved the fact that there was so much diversity here in New Zealand and openness to different sorts of genres of music. So you know, I think. The first five spools we actually got rid of trance, much to the disgust.
The chagrin, I love that
the
word.
The disgust of the trance scene could not believe that we pretty much oust it. And but that was maybe by the third one.
Yeah.
So you know, I even at the second one we had Dallas and Moo playing, and you know,
we had
all sorts of great music. We had house DJs playing. We had drum and bass, we had all sorts of DJs playing. And so I think, you know, and we did three at Kariatahi before we moved to Waharau, which is where, you know, 2002, Spool 2002 was probably my most favourite Spool and the biggest tipping point for Spool, where we moved sites and really started to add the content. We had a lot more live music. That's when Fat Freddy's first played in the Geodesic Dome, where they filmed the Hope video.
Now,
that was probably the most.
I find any event, especially large scale, extraordinary. That fascinates me, like what people achieve putting them together. So I was just thinking there, I'm going to ask you a bit more about this later, about what I spoke to there. But I'd imagine that, once you start introducing live bands and stuff, the level of kind of production and things you need to do changes as well.
Huge.
Huge.
And level of production.
Not just cassette Walkmans now.
We've moved a little bit beyond that by then.
No. Well, it's still a huge thing to set up. But
no, I know. And, you know, of course, having I mean, that Spool 2002 was insane. We imported a geodesic dome and a whole troupe from Burning Man. We put a sound system into a round space, and we had, thank God, we had a really good French sound engineer that could spiral the sound. We had Fat Freddy's in the middle, and the crowd around them like this. It was extraordinary.
And that's in the Hope video, like you say, the footage in that.
That's exactly when that happened. And I'll never forget that moment when that was happening.
Wow.
It was electric. There was literally people, there were sparks. I mean, you know, being the festival producer, you are completely straight, always and always. But the magic,
Endorphins.
And I don't mean this to sound like a dippy, trippy hippie here, but because I'm not one anymore. But it was electric and magic, and nothing like that had been experienced before. It wasn't just them. Then we had Tom Bailey and Holy Water producing, so classical Indian musicians playing with Tom Bailey and Isaac Tucker and James Pinker. We had so much amazing new content that had never been experienced or seen before at that festival. And it was the beginning of Splore really starting to blossom and grow.
Yeah.
Now, at that time, we were, you know, trying to make it, and we were just breaking even and trotting along. But it was in 2004 when we actually lost quite a bit of money, that things actually went, okay, the commercial reality is we have not been doing this very well.
I'd imagine, as I say, the fatigue of putting it all on, that's just not a great ending to another round.
It's not. Our biggest lessons were doing things like giving away far too many complimentary tickets.
And flying in the 25-strong alternative circus troupe.
That's true.
Which is amazing. But
No, well, that was the year that we actually managed to break even.
But
the following
I did look at that
year,
and go, that's an experience. expensive. That's an expensive add-on. Yeah.
We didn't fly them. They paid themselves. Yeah. We paid for the dome to come over.
Anyway.
You know. But
so you were getting to your to, yeah. to 2004. You lost a considerable amount of money, yourself and your partner, and...
Yeah. And not only did we just lose money, but my partner and I were splitting up. So it was one of those really shitty times.
It all comes
actually
at once.
And actually my next partner, Al Green, who is now a really good mate of mine, but, you know, it was and we had put Splore on for 3 years together along with Morgan until a certain time. So it was messy. And so someone approached me and told me to go and have a chat to John Minty, that maybe he was interested in having a chat with you. And the fortunate thing is John had come to not just that Splore, but I think he'd come to the one before, and he could, you know. I mean, John's always been cruising in the background checking stuff out, you know.
Quick aside, I've met Al a couple of times, once at a 40th and elsewhere. Lovely man. Yes. We connected
totally lovely
away.
Man.
Yeah, I love quirky people.
Oh, he's
big
a
time.
Very quirky man and an awesome human being. And, you know, we had a lot of good times putting Splore on together as well.
And, you know, just a few, yes, just some other questions around that and sort of I've thought about other things of like, the planning side really fascinates me and the like thinking about what are we going to do to kind of have this at a vibe we want it to have it at and still have it commercially viable. You know what I'm meaning, that fine line in the middle. I'm sure you know it a thousand times more than I. Weirdly particular question, but is something like instituting the dress-up tradition part of that? Like sort of, you know, not just making it a kind of free-for-all of people turning up? Little things like that important?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I guess one of the things that was...
people come over the hill.
What was different about Splore from 2002 onwards is that it wasn't all about the music, and it never was always about the music. It was always about community and the music and what could happen when the music, the community in that sort of
and
environment.
And the installations and the performers.
So that's when 2002, we've had our first lot of installations. We had, you know, some serious sort of performance going on, and it was all the other content that really started to cement Splore as something that wasn't just some sort of outdoor dance party or festival. And the dress up side of things really didn't start happening until 2008. And that was a particularly interesting year where we introduced what's now known as the Living Lounge, and we had the extraordinary international burlesque performers, and we had comedy, and we had
spoken word stuff. And,
it was amazing. But to enter the special Saturday night, you had to dress up and the theme, and that was and you couldn't actually get in to see the show unless you were dressed up, and that was really making people take that extra effort. Really pushing people to just go beyond the norm.
And really engage and be
really
a part of this thing that is this thing.
Yeah, that's right. And so that was the big tipping point with the beginning of starting to get people to dress up. I mean, you know, what I love about what Splore has done since I left in 2014 is, you know, I think the tagline that it is New Zealand's biggest dress-up party is the perfect thing, you know. And now... people spend months getting ready to dress up for Splore.
I think they used to say that about the rugby sevens in Wellington.
Possibly they would have, you know, but I think...
Quite different events.
Yeah, and, you know, the magic of Splore is everything that is created with intent and inclusiveness, and it's all those... it's all the parts that make it special.
Inclusiveness means so many things, because I was thinking, like, even just general festival, just the general what a festival is has changed so much since the 90s. So inclusiveness now to me is also about, you know, people being there with their toddlers and their whatevers and people not feeling like, you know, there's something there for everyone, and it kind of, there's that, it runs at that pace, doesn't it? So that it doesn't kind of go 200% the whole time. It has its ebbs and flows.
Yeah.
And I'd imagine all that's quite an interesting thing to learn about by trial and error in programming too. When do we bring it down for a while? When do we make this bit kick off? When do we...
Yeah, no, it is. It is. There's a real art to that. Yeah. Knowing how to...
You'd learn a whole lot about a whole lot of things. Human psychology, you know, crowds.
Definitely.
You know,
and I think another really important... area that we started to market with Splore from 2006 was making it family friendly, and that really was another a key a real key cog in the wheel to the audiences that we started to attract as well.
Quite differentiates from a lot of the festivals out there in New Zealand, man.
It does, and it just means that having children there is a real leveler. And now parents either bring their kids and they share the duties together with other parents, or they leave them at home and have a good time. You know, it's either or. You know, and but you know, now it's just such an. You know, I can't imagine a Splore without kids anymore, you know, because it just creates such a beautiful vibe and energy. And it
reminds me of like a very mini moment version of that. And years ago, like I was fifth form, 1991, there's this legendarily like out of control AC/DC show in Wellington. And there's a number of things. I find it really kind of fascinating, as I say, because I find events quite fascinating. It was basically like, people in general hadn't really learned about crowd control. The event got delayed because of the wind in New Zealand. They couldn't get their big stage set up. So all these people stuck around town. A lot of them hadn't booked accommodation and they just drank beer in bars. Yep. No water provided, blah, blah, blah. Mm. Just there's some quite extraordinary footage of it online.
I can imagine.
But funnily enough, that was at Athletic Park, which was a really iconic outdoor venue. And then the council just went, nah, there's no more shows ever happening at Athletic Park. Mm-hmm. And then it changed. They had one more, and it was Dire Straits. And the only reason they let it happen is they said, we'll let you promoters do this if every ticket gets someone in under 15 for free. Nice.
Yeah, lovely.
See what I mean? So they filled it up.
Yes.
They filled it up, what you're saying.
Yeah.
Like adults and children together is a different,
it's a different
vibration.
It's definitely, totally good thing to happen.
And then I know you didn't really book the music, but I also know, of course, you'd be very privy to a lot of this. I was interested in, like, I'd imagine there's been discussions about what we speak of wanting to broaden the market but not change the market for the worse. There must have been artists that you've talked about that have sat on the borderline of, shall we book them or shall we not book them?
Yeah, and John and I definitely had, I mean, more so when John came aboard and John introduced some pretty key international hip-hop acts.
Yeah.
And I think the whole hip-hop element that got brought into Splore was disliked by a lot of people. And
so you also get closed-mindedness on the other side as well.
Really exciting for a lot of people, you know. I guess there were some slightly controversial acts, but really I think the interesting one, I guess one of the most interesting acts that we booked.
I love the Cuban Brothers every year, by the way. It's just a complete aside.
No, I love the Cuban Brothers as well. I mean,
I'd love to have him on here. No, people don't know he's got the thickest Kiwi accent and he's from Palmerston North.
Well, you could probably arrange a Skype thing with Mike. That sort of thing.
I'm going to go through you. So the artist, artist.
Artist that actually was kind of, was Erykah Badu.
I was going to ask about her anyway.
Actually, she was the most difficult artist we'd ever had.
Totally different to the ethos in terms of her approach to how she deals with everyone. And
yeah, she's
prima donna, late.
Very prima donna, downright rude, actually. and, you know, she sold Splore out.
Yeah.
Everyone wanted to see Erykah Badu. Yeah. And I thought she was going to attract a really... I knew she was going to attract a big audience, but I didn't realise that she was actually going to attract kind of a... there was a percentage of the crowd that were quite young and bogan.
Yeah.
Which was really interesting.
Yeah.
I hated that Splore. That was my one Splore I disliked.
Look,
really, like, oh my God, nothing more could go wrong.
You know,
she wouldn't come to the Pulpiri.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and
normally, especially like a lot of African-American artists really dig that part of...
she didn't leave until... we had the right side SUV to bring her out to the event. And anyhow, it was an interesting experience. I'm not going to bitch about her because she's obviously an incredible musician and an amazing, amazing.
I think it's great you've talked about it and diplomatically, and it confirms a number of things I sort of figured based on watching what unfolded. Yeah. I was there that year.
Yeah, no, it's a really tough year. Yeah. And it was tough because we'd sold out, and it was only that we'd maybe had another 1,000 people more than the year before, but what we didn't realise is on that site, 1,000 people is a lot of people.
You had 1,000 extra.
It's from the year before. Yeah, yeah. And 1,000 people doesn't sound like a lot of people,
when you've got port-a-loos, when you've got roads, when you've got staff on gates, when you've got infrastructures getting pushed.
It was really interesting and quite, it was very stressful. Yeah. And then, of course, we had things like the bloody yachties.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it just couldn't...
She is almost worse than Erica Badu.
Oh, no, they were way worse. That was that was the worst.
So we're talking like sort of in-story. A number of listeners will know, but my understanding is that some a-hole person who had one of the yacht moorings just emptied their sewage and took off. Did I know this is like gossipy stuff. Did you ever get any intel on who it might have been?
No, we didn't.
What I do hope is that they know that they did it. They were made aware of the impact and that they do feel bad about it, but then they would have approached
you. You know what was so horrible about it is obviously how it affected
The pool on the beach, so I couldn't go swimming?
No, that aside. But what was really interesting is that we as the organisers were blamed for it for a number of years afterwards. It's like it was our fault that happened because we didn't have enough port-a-loos or because something like that.
It's not port-a-loos on a yacht.
It was just, you know what I mean. When there's something bad that happens at a festival, punters, no matter what, will always look to find someone to blame.
The audience took that out on you guys.
A lot of people were really just really rude to us about that and held on to it. But, you know, this is one of the hardest things about doing a festival and then doing a festival successfully, where people in their minds, they do these calculations, okay, that's that many tickets at that price. Shit, they must be making a lot of money. It's very tough sometimes and people can be very critical. And, you know, I'm quite a sensitive human being and I often would take it all so personally.
Yeah, don't read the comments.
Comments. It was better I didn't a lot of the time.
Fucking comments.
But it is. And you
stop commenting. Do something.
You talked about before about the commercial reality and that fine balance. And I have to say that is one of the hardest things. It's like you want to keep it underground and a little bit special and magic and whatever. And you've got to actually make it commercially viable, or else it wouldn't exist. And you know, I hugely salute John for taking it on and continue to take it. Every year he does it, he takes the risk himself.
So people can read more about, because what happened in 2012, there's a couple of articles with you and stuff, but really if we take, you know, there was the torrential downpour on Friday, there was the extra 1,000 people, there was Erica Badu being Erica Badu.
Yep.
Then we go to Sunday or whenever it was that the
boat leak.
You come out of that, and I sort of want to, there are two sides of things. Like, how do you reconcile that? Like, are you just like, fuck it, I'm over this.
Yeah.
But then you don't do that. So what changes to make you kind of like, go, I can move forward with this?
Yeah. You're right. I was over it. But I also knew that I was determined to do it better.
Yeah.
And that's actually what motivated me to keep going. It's like I am, because I knew also at that time that my time with Splore was not too far off coming to an end. And I just wanted to make sure that however I finished Splore, that I went out on a high, that I stopped and I did it really well. And that I had ticked all the boxes that I personally wanted to tick, but also what I wanted to do for the festival. Stubborn for the good. So I knew that I had definitely one more in me, and also that was the time that we really introduced the very strong sustainability program into the festival with the reusable cups, the parking fees, all those sorts of things that we were introducing at that time in 2014. And the theme that was around love, it was like, we've just got to change, because the vibe didn't feel... Lots of people loved the Yoruka Badu Festival, but I
personally... I had a good time at that festival.
And lots of people did, and that's all good.
But I could tell that
I
was...
I was just like, actually, this is not what I want Splore to be, and it's got to change. And we've learned a lot of lessons on logistics and operations, so let's make the last one... Well, let's make the next one the absolute best I can. And we did a lot of really cool things on that Splore, and it was a beautiful energy and a beautiful vibe. It was a full moon. It was a lot less people, and that was interesting as well.
Did you purposely cap the tickets this time around?
No. We unfortunately, well, I mean, in many ways, I think it was fortunate, but actually, it was one of those Eminem booked for the Saturday Splore. And while they're slightly different audiences...
There is still some crossover.
No, we would have lost probably 400 people.
Because for some people, he's a holy grail artist that they want to see.
I had friends that went to that.
I'd totally go and see him.
Absolutely get it. But it came, you know, well after we had booked our dates and were underway with planning. And while, let's just say, he took 400 people from the Splore audience, that's kind of your...
Once you get to your bottom line, everything above... Yeah.
I mean, actually a little bit of...
That's the small amount of tickets that the people you talked about before, they think you're rolling around in, like, Scrooge and your coins, but it's actually those final tickets.
Yeah, for 47,000 at the Western Springs is nothing. No, but 400 people for Splore was a fucking lot of people.
Absolutely.
But the energy and the mood at that one was just extraordinary. It was such... I loved it.
I was there. That was at that one too. I haven't been to every one, but I was at that one too, for sure.
It was a really just chilled, nice, easy... I can't even remember what acts we had.
I was going to say, can you remind me? I can't remember. Did you say 2014?
I'm sure we had good
vintage, that one.
Good vintage.
It was a good vintage.
And I'd been working towards discussions with John about how I was getting ready to depart.
And so it's still biannual then, eh? So you're sort of... That's great that you went from to that one is one of the ones that's... Yeah. You know, that I'll cherish out of all the great moments I've had at all of them. That's fantastic.
Yeah, totally.
Then you did another one after that, didn't you? 2016? No, that was the last one.
No,
do you enjoy going back as a punter?
So no, then from 15. Yeah. So 15 was the first annual. It's been annual ever since.
But you finished in 14.
That was my last.
Do you go back? Eh?
I go back and I just got booked for the lineup this year.
Fantastic! What are you going to play? You got to play Goa Trance. You've got to play it on two Sony cassette decks.
I should. I absolutely should if I could find a Sony cassette deck.
What sort of music do you play now? I mean, it's a sort of question I can't really answer. I play bits and bobs of everything. Yeah, but are you better question. Are you booked for like a pumping middle of the night set, or are you doing an afternoon thing? Or
so the last 3 years I've been playing at the Lucky Star Zone at sort of peak time, sort of midnight, 10 till midnight, midnight till 2. I play lots of – I play everything. My sets are disco to techno.
Great.
Okay, so I do – I play a lot of funk and disco. I play a lot of a bit of house, bit of tech house. But, you know, for me, my music is – because I love dancing. And
well, you're doing morning people, I see, as well.
I have done morning people.
Enjoyable?
I did
– My mother's like, what? My mother goes to the gym, the one
well,
next
morning
to
morning people here in
Auckland.
People clubbing
all night, and I'm like, no, they get up and go to it. It's very different to
– I did do a morning people in Wellington. Well, in Wellington, morning people did not take off like Auckland morning people. Okay. And when I did it
– Wellington are not morning people. I'm from Wellington. That's probably it.
Exactly it. Yeah. I did morning people here in Auckland, and I loved it. So I've also just been booked for Rhythm and Alps and the Wahine Toa Night.
Through Elmo?
I hadn't had
a name for myself for years, nor was I pursuing DJing like that. I, you know, got a found a daytime life. And it's actually where I met Elle is at Elmo's 40th I got invited to via a friend.
Yes.
The long story short is my friend says, bring your Serato box along. And I'm not going to a thing at the Rhythm and Vine site and playing with all these people who are, you know, like I'm sort of out of that loop. But there was sort of two or three people with music. I played, Elmo and I hit it off.
Yeah.
He books me for Rhythm and Alps to go down there and do some crewing as well to make it worth my while. This story actually gets fantastic. So I go, okay, well, I'm no one to anyone on that bill. My name's on the thing, whatever, and I'll probably play it like 1 p.m. on one of the...
Yeah.
He books me on... There's two stages. He books me on New Year's Eve, midnight till 1:30, with DJ Zinc on the other stage.
Oh, brilliant.
And I end up with like 3,000 people and trees around me, a crowd with a horizon. It was fucking amazing.
Oh, that is so cool.
And we never really followed up a lot because I really dig the guy.
But
I just see him every now and again since his 40th.
Yeah.
But it was just like, wow. I love how he does those things on a whim because it's his party.
He's a really good guy. I mean, I got to know him because before he started doing Rhythm
and Arts. And I didn't freak out, may I add. I owned it.
It's fantastic.
Because you think, you know, when you're not doing it all the time,
that's
a big call. But I actually was like, okay, I've got this.
No, so I'm playing with a whole group. It's all women playing in the Log Cabin.
Great. The world's smallest nightclub. The minuscule of sound.
The minuscule of sound.
And this is a sort of a stock question, but I think it's really worth asking. And like, there'll be way more than you remember now. You mentioned a couple. But what are some of your like, this is all worth it moments you remember from Splore over the years?
Yeah. Yes, there has been a few.
Three out, that'll be fine.
Yeah, no, so definitely Fat Freddy's 2002, Great. Geodesic Dome.
Yeah.
I think some of my most, Orbital, three years ago? Epic, more epic than I could have possibly imagined. I loved the stage because they were some of my favourites from the 2000s.
And you always wonder what those, I guess that you kind of call them heritage acts are going to do all that time later.
They did way better than I ever thought. So that was incredible. I think some of my other favourites have actually been the Sunday afternoons on main stage. So I think Mr. Scruff's Sunday Afternoon
I've got a copy of that. Someone gave me that. He's one of my favourite kind of DJs, and I've somehow got 4 hours of that set on the computer, and it's nowhere near, I imagine, like being there.
Oh, no, it was superb. And I think those have been magic moments. I think Butterfly Zoo in 2008 was just extraordinary.
No, that's good. I think we've done remarkably well. It's really been really engaging. And
have we knocked it out in 40 minutes?
This is an hour and 10.
Oh, really?
I told you it was fly. So is this the most you've talked? Did you talk to me more about Spore than you did Kim?
Kim was 10 minutes.
Okay.
And I didn't let her ask too many questions. I just spoke for 10 minutes so she couldn't
She probably didn't know what Goa Trance was like I do.
No.